Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
We do a better job of passing on our fanship of our local sports teams than we do passing on our faith to the next generation.
Woo!
Right? Because we know our sports
teams. Stepping on some toes, Jim.
Dude, right now, we're in fantasy football. But we have to do a better job of understanding the history of the church and why these objections don't hold water, because that's really more important than our fantasy football teams.
Has there ever been a question about God or faith or the Bible that kept you up at night? Well, then today is your day. We've asked folks to send in those deep, dark, uncomfortable, nagging questions, because today we're unloading all of them on a professional Christian apologist. This is my friend, J. Warner Wallace, founder of Cold Case Christianity, and he's here to take the heat of all your pressing objections. All right, my friend, are you ready for this grilling?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so the first one's actually from me, so I'm cheating a little bit. And so a little bit of background, my entire dad's side of the family is Hindu.
Okay.
In fact, what's up, Dad, if you're watching? And he poses this question quite often, okay. It's a compelling one, which is, hey, listen, it's cool what you believe, but you're Christian more than likely because you grew up in the West. If you would have grown up in India, like me, you'd be Hindu. Or if you grew up in Syria or Saudi Arabia, you'd be Muslim. And are people who grew up in Mumbai or Chennai or, you know, someplace like going to hell, eternity away from God, just because of where they grew up, or maybe they've never even heard the gospel? It just seems a little unfair. What say you?
Well, okay, first of all, is it true it's often true that we grow up in an area where we have access to ideas and we end up embracing those ideas? As a matter of fact, what you believe as an adult is most likely something you got from your parents. We see that kind of transmission of ideas now. But I grew up in an area where I never met a Christian.
Hmm.
I mean, if I don't remember anyone ever like telling me anything about Jesus or inviting me to church, yet here I am. So I don't know that it's always the case. And certainly the first Christians did not grow up in an area where Christianity was favored.
Mm, that's a good point.
They didn't have anybody around them that was, you know, kind of coercing them into Christianity or even offering the truth of Christianity. They actually came out of an entirely anti-Christian environment, and yet we have a huge movement of Christianity that occurs. I actually think that God does the work in this, and that God is the one who reaches us. And he reaches people just like me, who you might think, well, there's just no, how are we going to reach this guy? He doesn't know anybody who's going to, well, God does amazing things. There's a lot of folks, for example, in the Muslim community that will say they were first reached by dreams.
Mm.
Nabil Qureshi is one of those folks who had a Christian friend who kind of argued with him a little bit, David
yeah.
Wood.
And he wrote a brilliant book called Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus. Which, that book, I cannot recommend.
Oh, it's an awesome book.
It's incredible.
And so this goes to show that God has the power to send, to reach, to intercede. And so I don't worry about those things. Now, do I feel it a burden to be the feet of, you know, to use my abilities to share the truth? Of course I do. But I also know that God is in control.
Let me press you a little bit. So what about monks who are, you know, really pressing into their Buddhism, or, you know, Hindu priests at temples in Kerala that are really pressing into their Hinduism to find God? Does it seem unfair that God would abandon them?
Well, it's okay. So there's belief in the true God, and there's everything else in a huge category. So as an atheist, I was for many years pressing into my atheism. Honestly, I loved the sciences, and I thought the Christians were such fools. That the only people I ever knew who were Christians were not as a kid. It was as an adult when I was making arrests. The people I was taking to jail would tell me they had just gotten saved. They were Christians. Oh, yeah. I know better. I shouldn't do this. You know, I'm a Christian. I go to church. I'm like, really? Okay, so if that's what it is, I just pressed even harder into my non-Christian beliefs. If you were somebody who was dying of tuberculosis, and I know the cure is isoniazid, but you are committed to Tylenol. You think Tylenol, that's cheaper, I can get it over the counter.
And I really believe that Tylenol, I sincerely believe that Tylenol will cure my TB. Well, should I let you go? Or should I, if there's a true cure,
wow,
should I encourage you to take the true cure? Even though you're convinced on a personal level, subjectively, this is my cure is Tylenol. Okay, well, I could let you go, but it's just going to result in your death. At some point, if there's a truth about the cure for TB, I should share it with you. Now, we're all facing death at some point. We're all facing an end to our material existence, right, if you're an atheist. If there's a cure to that, should I share it with you? And you might say, well, no, I like Tylenol. I like this other thing. I find purpose in this other thing. But if it's true that there's a cure, and like every other cure, it's the cure, should I share it with you? I think I should.
Yeah.
And why would you be surprised that all the alternatives would not work? If there's one true cure, this is true in a spiritual sense too, if there's one true cure for your spiritual death,
wow,
shouldn't I share it with you? And why would you be surprised that not every cure will work? And that some people will be sincerely committed to their other notions of their cure, but could be sincerely wrong at the same time.
I've never heard it put that way, but that makes a lot of sense.
And so it's just a matter of us deciding, is this objectively true? Let me just rabbit trail for a second with you. Look, we all know the world's got lots of subjective claims. So if I said to you that ice cream is the best dessert, well, that's my subjective view. That claim is grounded in me as the subject. So we call that a subjective truth claim. But if I say that isoniazid is the cure for TB, well, I don't decide that with my will. I don't decide that with my opinion. That's grounded in the thing called isoniazid. It's grounded in the object.
Come on.
And so that's an objective truth claim. Now, look, if I said Tylenol is the cure for TB, that's also an objective claim because it's not grounded in your opinion. It's grounded in you're making a claim about Tylenol. Okay, but here's the problem. It's false. And so there are false objective claims. As a matter of fact, once you discover that a claim is objective, grounded in the object, rather than subjective, grounded in the subject, the only thing left to do is determine if it's true or false.
Wow.
So the claim that God exists, that's not a subjective claim. That's an objective claim. He may not exist. It could be a false objective claim, but I can't make it so by willing it. I can't keep it from being so by willing it. It's not grounded in me as an opinion. It's grounded in the object known as God. If I said to you, Jesus is the only way to God, that is also an objective claim about reality. I can't make it so by desiring it, and I can't keep it from being so by desiring. It's grounded in the nature of the object known as Jesus. So we have to ask ourselves the question, it's not as though all of these things will cure TB. They all could fail or one could succeed. They can't all succeed because they make absolutely opposite claims. So if Christianity is right, then Hinduism is wrong. Mm. If Hinduism is right, Christianity is wrong. They make opposite claims. So the question is, are any of them right? And if they are, should we all start paying attention to that one? That's what we have to do.
Wow, that is extremely, extremely helpful. I'm excited to go on because
I'm not sure I'm excited about it. I don't know what kind of questions you have.
Well,
there.
I'm saving the spiciest for last.
All right, go ahead.
All right, so this second question, this one's from Johnny. Given that the books making up biblical canon were developed over time, and given that many books of the Bible were also developed over time, with pieces being grafted onto old scrolls, Proverbs and Psalms being easy examples of that, why should we trust what we have now is canon? What makes it different than any other man-made writing like the Quran or the Book of Mormon? What can we point to, especially in history, that bears out that this was inspired by God?
Oh, golly. Okay, so there's a lot to answer there. I'm going to try to give you the shortest possible answer. Okay, first of all, the idea this is kind of cobbled together over time is simply untrue, and it can be demonstrated with the evidence that it's not cobbled together over time. So I'll just go the longer way. We test accounts in history. We test accounts in even modern, even current history. If I have an account from 35 years ago where somebody says, this is how the murder occurred, I work cold cases most of my career, so this is always the nature of my cases. They are unsolved murders. You test eyewitnesses under four criteria, which we have already talked about, but it's are they written early enough?
Because if that's the case, we don't have to worry about them being cobbled together over centuries. Two, can they be corroborated in some way? Three, have they changed over time? That's a big claim you're trying to make here. And four, is there a reason why they might lie to us, a bias? Well, let's go to the, this is kind of centered on the third question. Have they changed over time? So here's what we do in crime scenes. We ask the question, because it could happen. You could have some piece of evidence in the crime scene, and 35 years later, I bring it to trial in a cold case. And sure enough, I don't know if somebody pulled it out of property and changed it 10 years in, and nobody saw it. So now I have this tampered piece of evidence. Kind of the same claim is happening with the scriptures, right? You have some version of Jesus, but they added a bunch of stuff we can't trust, and then we get it in the canon of scripture. Well, how do we test that? Well, we ask a question in the crime scene. Hey, was there somebody who saw that? Like, who's the officer who collected that evidence? And back in the day, believe it or not, we didn't have a lot of CSI officers back in the 60s and 70s. The officer may have collected it himself. Maybe he took a Polaroid. He wrote a report, certainly, describing the piece of evidence. Then he brings it to the property room where they make another report, whether they're receiving. If my dad, for example, was a cop, if he touched it as a detective, he would make a report about what he saw. Then he brings it to the next guy. They write a report, brings it to the next guy. By the time I check it out of property 30 years later, I'm writing a report. Now I've got image after image after image and report after report after report over time. And they are like links in a chain that connect the past to the present. And I tell you what, that description of that piece of property better not change. Whatever I'm describing over here 30 years later, it better match the very first description. We call this, in evidence terms, the chain of custody. Do we have a chain of custody that is uninterrupted, that we can actually see if the evidence has changed along the way? Well, the same thing can be done with the New Testament. So if John is our author of a Gospel of John, like, who are the officers he gives it to? I'm not sure what John's Gospel says. For all I know, John's Gospel is very, very simple. It's a Jesus who's not miraculous, maybe. Maybe all that stuff was added. How do I know? Well, who did he give it to? Who's the next link in the chain of custody? He had three personal students, Ignatius, Polycarp, and Papias. Lucky for us, they wrote about what they learned sitting at the feet of the eyewitnesses. So I can read their documents. We get seven letters from Ignatius, one from Polycarp. We can see, is Jesus less spectacular, or are all the divine elements of Jesus available in the very next link in the chain? Mm. Their student is Irenaeus. We can check him. His is Hippolytus. We can check him. And you keep on doing this through history to see if the thing has changed, if what this claim is this has been cobbled together.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
No. The Jesus that we know today, the miraculous, born of a virgin, worked miracles, raised from the dead, ascended into heaven, that dude has not changed. Those claims have not changed. They're present in the very first link, second link, third link, fourth link. There's no adaptation. If you want to say he's a late legend, he'd have to be two things, late and a legend, and he's neither. So we can't, I'm certain of is the story of Jesus. Yeah, you can still reject it. But to argue that I'm rejecting it because it's changed over time is just doesn't match the evidence.
Wow.
So I think in the end, I never had a problem with that. But here's what's even, I think, more astounding about it, is that what's in your canon, there were some books that the early church used that are not in your New Testament. First Clement. The early church read First Clement, a letter written by a disciple of Paul, who was actually one of the first two bishops in Rome. So this guy, first century character, he actually wrote a letter called First Clement. It's beautiful, not in your Bible. Epistle of Barnabas, not in your Bible. Shepherd of Hermas, used by the first century believers, not in your Bible. Why? Not written by witnesses. One of the earliest criteria for what's in your Bible is it had to be somebody, as Peter said, who touched Jesus, who saw him, as John said. We just saw this. We were the ones who interacted with the Word. So if you look at all the books of your Bible, the ones that came in, had the most contention about whether we should include them or not, are ones that, number one, were either hard to understand, like Revelation, because that's the other criteria. Is it edifying? Does it tell us something about Jesus that we can take and grow from? And Revelation, for a lot of early readers, was like, I'm not even sure what it means. Should we include it? But Hebrews, Should we put it in? Well, like, who wrote it? If it's written by Apollos, it's out. He's not an eyewitness. Paul? Okay. Peter? Okay. But Apollos, he can't be in. So it turns out that gave me great comfort as an investigator to know that's an early criteria. And as a matter of fact, who are the earliest speakers of the gospel, of the truth of Jesus? Well, they are all eyewitnesses. So when Judas is taken out of the mix, who do they replace him with? Upper room, Acts 1. Peter says, hey, we need another eyewitness. Somebody who has seen Jesus from the baptism to the resurrection. That's who we need, because it turns out this is all going to be based on eyewitness testimony.
Wow.
So that's why I trust those earliest reports, because they are the, and even the skeptic like a Bart Ehrman will agree, that of all the stories of Jesus that have ever been written in antiquity, the earliest are the four gospels. And that's the first test. Are they written early enough? Look, if you want to lie about Jesus, here's what you do. You wait till everyone who knows the truth about Jesus is dead. Then you can say whatever you want. But if you're going to write early in the first century, at the same time that people are available to tell you that you're wrong,
yeah,
that's dicey.
And I think that's such a huge distinction, is that these people who wrote this weren't just believing. They were eyewitnesses.
Well, and look at it this way. What convenient truism do I get out of I'm Paul? What do I get out of this? What am I getting out of this? I'm just getting beat up. I'm just getting imprisoned. Like, what's in it for me? Like, what worldly thing that typically drives us? And if you're thinking, well, it's his esteem, look, I had that. I was one of the best students of one of the best rabbis in the first century. I had enough power to draw up papers to execute Christians with a group that wasn't considered to be this lowly Christian. I was with the Jews. So why would I jump out of this group where I already have what you think I'm trying to get? I already have it.
Yeah.
To me, this argument that there's something in it for them just doesn't hold up. I'm so frustrated with our inability as a church family to be able to answer the questions in our own mind,
yeah,
especially for our kids.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that most studies will show you this, that it's not that you have to have an answer for your doubting son or your doubting daughter. It's just you have to be the kind of person that allows the question.
Yeah.
If you're going to stifle the question, that skepticism is going to turn into deconversion usually, deconstruction. But if you're somebody who's like, yeah, you can ask this question. Look, we do a better job of passing on our fanship of our local sports teams than we do passing on our faith to the next generation.
Woo.
Right? Because we know our sports
teams. Stepping on some toes, Jim.
Dude, right now, we're in fantasy football. I can tell you, I know why my team, I constructed this team a certain way. But we have to do a better job of understanding the history of the church and why these objections don't hold water, because that's really more important than our fantasy football teams.
Ready for question three?
Yep.
All right, Christina asks, we know Easter and Christmas days are borrowed traditions from pagan holidays. We know that there were plenty of dying and rising gods in the ancient world. We know that there are many similarities between cultures and religions, like the flood story, for example. Mm-hmm. So how do we know that the idea of Jesus of Nazareth dying and rising from the dead isn't just some conglomeration of a bunch of older ideas and myths?
Okay, so this is one I've done a lot of work on, because this is one of the biggest objections I had in mind. I could have said that. I could have spoken that objection pretty close to the way it was just spoken. So that was my view. And so I've written a lot about this in a book called Person of Interest. But here's what I would say. Number one, the fact that we are going to co-opt something that's precious to you to celebrate something that's true, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't invalidate. Do I think that Jesus was born in December? I don't. I've written about that online too. I don't think so. Mm. I don't think from the biblical text. I think it's probably a spring, but that's okay. The fact that we converted an entire body of people because we simply celebrated the truth on the same day they celebrated a lie. Okay, that's not unusual for everyone who holds a view. But here's a more important claim. Is Jesus just another dying and rising savior? Because there seem to be similarities. Here's what I did. Most people make these claims when they haven't really studied the mythologies they say that was copied for Jesus. Oh, he's like Mithras. Oh, he's like Horus. He's like Osiris. Read those mythologies. And here's what I did. I went back and I read all of the major mythologies. And I made a list of any time I saw a similarity between all the mythologies. And what I discovered, like 15 common characteristics of these ancient stories about God.
And that shouldn't surprise you, because all of them are basically just reflect our expectation of God. What's interesting about it is that none of the ancient myths have all 15 attributes until you get to Jesus of Nazareth.
Hmm.
C.S. Lewis puts it this way, that those ancient myths are the myths of men. He's using the word myth to mean not a lie, a story about God. Whereas Jesus is the myth of God. Those were the works of men who were thinking about God. Jesus is God incarnate, who actually personifies every expectation of the ancients. But if you think that somehow the virgin birth, the dying on a cross, this is so different, yes, broadly speaking, it matches the expectations of the ancients. But wouldn't you want that to be the case? Like, yeah, if you're thinking hard about God, this is what Paul says on Mars Hill. He says, you people here are very religious. You got all kinds of monuments. There's one here for the unknown God. Well, tell you what, you're kind of right and kind of wrong. I'm here to introduce you to who we saw with our own eyes, who will blow you away, who will meet every expectation and more that you have for God. Why? Because he is God. So don't be surprised that the real God will meet your expectations. If you think hard about God, some of those expectations will be met. Some places you're just going to be wrong. But that's what you see in the history of our ideas about God. Now, by the way, if you think that Jewish inventors of Jesus in the first century are thinking, I'm going to invent a God to sell to my other Jewish members of my community, Jews who have been told their entire existence that they are to reject the pagan gods. They are not to get involved with the pagan gods. So I'm going to go ahead and cobble together a story to convince these Jewish believers using all of the pagan mythology around us. Okay, that's like the worst strategy possible for this particular group.
Right.
But if it just so happens that the story of Jesus is true and he might meet your expectations, it's not just the pagans. I say pagans, I mean the non-Jews, that he meets expectations. Well, it turns out if I described the attributes of Jesus, I could very well be describing David, because so much of David's story matches Jesus, or Jonah, or Joshua. It turns out that the same expectations have been developed within the Jewish community, because the archetypes, the patriarchs, they foreshadow Jesus. So Jesus comes, the one man, the one God who comes and meets all the expectations of the non-Jews and all of the types of the Jews.
Wow.
So he to me, all that stuff about how similar he is to ancient mythology is not an evidence against Jesus. It's an evidence for Jesus.
Wow.
That's a long answer to a short question.
You just say it so eloquently, and I'm just so thankful, because it's beyond helpful. There's obviously a lot more questions we could get after, but there's one that always comes up that's the spiciest of them all.
All right.
We'll have this be our last one.
Okay.
This is the one that when we kind of polled people like, hey, what would you want to hear? This is the one that keeps coming up. All right, here he comes. Can there be an all good, all powerful, all knowing God coexisting with the evil in this world? How can a benevolent God create a world with such suffering? Why doesn't all good God allow evil? Why doesn't he just intervene to stop evil?
Okay, a couple of things here. This is a harder question to answer, because if you asked me, I often get asked this kind of question, why, if there's an all good, all powerful God, even if there isn't, why did this happen to my 10-year-old daughter? And I had a case like that. It was my dad's case first. It was a 1972 murder. 10 years old, terrible, brutal murder. I was 11 at the time, and it shook us. And years later, when I reopened it, that was a question that gets asked. Why, how could anyone do this? And why would this happen to my daughter? Well, it turns out that question requires a number of variables. That's how we solve the case. So in a similar way, if I answer this question broadly, why does evil occur in a world that's supposedly governed by an all-powerful and all-loving God? Well, there's a number of variables. Why would you be surprised? And this is the truth when you're solving any act of evil, you're investigating any act of evil. So I would say there's a couple of things. Now, without going through all of them, I'll just give you some things to chew on. The first is you have to have a proper view of eternity. So as an atheist, my view of life was a certain kind of geometry. It was a line segment.
starts with birth. It extends through to the point of death. And that's all you get. And I'm hoping to get 90, 95 clean years, drop dead in my sleep after a nice pasta dinner. Like, I don't want any pain. But if I get cancer at 40 and I suffer for 10 years and die, I'm going to be upset. That's going to be evil in my view because I had an expectation of 90 clean. Now, what if, though, my view of the life is wrong? What if the geometry is wrong? What if life is not a line segment, but is instead a ray? Starts at point of birth, extends through that point of death, and goes off infinitely in that direction. Well, now that's different because there are people you know who've had surgeries when they were a baby. By the time they were three, they didn't even, it was terrible. If I stopped them at the surgery and I could talk to them, how's life going for you? They say it's terrible. Why would God allow this? Now, by the time they're three, they don't remember the surgery. Evil is always measured in the context of your lifetime and your expectations. Mm. So if this view of life is true, the ray, well, it turns out that every year you're on the second other side of the second dot, you're in eternity. Well, by comparison, your 90 years is shorter. 1,000 years into eternity, your 90 years is very small. 1,000,000 years into eternity, your 90 years is a millisecond. The question is, so you can have the worst 90 years possible. But if our worldview is true, that's just like that surgery you had when you were a baby. You have to live in the context of eternity, not in the context of the line segment. Eternity changes everything. Now, you should have a problem if they're an atheist because all you get is 90 years for all your desires to be met, all justice to be, all evil to be vanquished, all justice to be achieved. Well, good luck with that. We don't have that worldview. Our lives, we are all eternal creatures. We have to measure anything in the context of eternity, not in the context of this week. And that's the thing that we don't do. Often as Christians, we live as though we are practical atheists. We think it all has to happen in this 90 years. Mm. We don't live with eternity in mind. So I think that's one aspect of it. Let me give you another one. I think that God, like we said before, we talked about love. You can't, if there's a loving, all-loving God, he is going to create a planet in which love is possible. But that means it's logically impossible to create a world where love can emerge without creating a world with free agency.
I think that's a massive point. Can you expand on that? I think that's such a crucial point that if God wanted to create a universe in which true, genuine love was actually possible, then in that space, people would, by definition, have to have the ability to reject that love.
That's right. And to do bad things. If you want people to be in a world where they can do genuine good, you have to have them have the opportunity, at least, to do genuine evil. Now, here's what a good God would do. It's not as though he's giving you this dangerous thing, free agency, and he's throwing the knife at you, not telling you how to catch it, you know, by the handle of the blade. No, he actually throws the knife and he gives you a book that will guide you so you will not abuse your free agency. Mm. Now, if you don't choose to read the book, you may abuse your free agency. But that's not because God has not given you the beautiful thing called free agency and given you the guidelines so you won't abuse free agency. Our goal then is to actually follow the guidelines. We may not do that, but that's part of the gamble. But again, it's okay because justice, you might say, well, then things are going to be unjust. Mm. Bad things are going to happen. Well, yeah, if it's a line segment. But if it's a ray, there's no crying on the other side of the second dot.
Right. And that to me is actually kind of a sad concept that if people that are atheists, I find, have a massive heart for justice, mm-hmm. which, bravo. If there's no God, there is no justice.
That's right. Well, so that's the other thing. Let's do one more step. I used to think this is the lamest explanation for evil in the world, which is, you know, does it build character? Like, could God be trying to achieve something in our character through evil? Like, how could this family who loses this daughter achieve anything in character? Mm. But here's the point. As an atheist, there are certain attributes of character that we all admire as atheists. We all love courage. Nobody loves a coward. We cherish courage. We cherish compassion. We cherish charity. Well, these are not things you just flip a button. If you want your kids to be courageous, you don't just say, okay, from now on, be courageous. No, courage is a response. Charity is a response. Compassion is a response. It's something you respond. So that means I've got to do something. I've got to actually, if you want a world in which courage is going to emerge, I have to design a world in which there's danger that you can respond to courageously. I have to design a world in which there's poverty you can respond to charitably.
That's a great point.
A world where there are challenges
and traumas that you can respond to with compassion. In other words, if you want the things that we all revere as atheists, you have to create a world that looks just like the one we're in.
That's a great point.
That's the world. This is why I never pray for patience. If you pray for patience, what's going to happen? God's going to give you something that requires that response, and nobody wants that. So again, all of these virtues are what God has designed into this environment, because you don't want to. Do you think it'd be better if God designed a world where there could be no virtues? That's ridiculous. So, but the last thing I would say is why are we calling this stuff evil to begin with? Like, what is the standard? You're saying it's evil because I don't like it, well, then you could change it. You could get rid of all evil tomorrow by simply changing your opinion of it. But it turns out you're saying, we're saying it's evil because we think it's objectively evil, regardless of my opinion. In other words, there's a standard by which we measure it. But that means there's God. If you think there's objective evil, things that are evil, no matter, it's never okay to torture babies for fun. Okay. If that's an objective evil, there'd have to be a standard of righteousness that is objective that you're using to measure. And by comparison, in other words, if evil is the shadow, I think Lewis also talked about this, then if there's no light, there are no shadows. So to argue that I don't like that there's shadows means that you have to first admit there has got to be light. So in the end, evil does not work as an evidence against the existence of an all-powerful, all-loving God. It actually is an evidence that there is one, because that's the standard that you think is missing here. Now, the question is, why would God allow this to happen? Well, that's what we're talking about, right? Is that why he would? One last thing on this. When someone offers this objection and they're saying there's an all-loving, all-powerful God, so there's the problem. He can't be both. Either he doesn't care, he could stop it, but he doesn't, or he can't stop it, then he's not all-powerful. Well, that's not the limited definition of God that we believe as Christians. God is just all-loving and all-powerful. You're missing some dimensions of God. One of the dimensions you're missing is that God is all-knowing. Now, an all-knowing God might allow evil because he knows something that's further down the domino chain than you do. He knows what good. I work a lot with officers who have suffered trauma. And if you suffer trauma, you're going along at a certain pace and you get the trauma knocks you to your knees. And if you stay down there and you can't perform anymore, you're suffering PTSD. If you can suffer the trauma and get back to where you were before, we call that resiliency. But if you suffer the trauma, I could actually help you to do even better than you were before the trauma. That's called post-traumatic growth. How do you do it? Well, the secular studies show it. It's called meaning making. It's trying to find sense in why this aspect of my life is part of my overarching story. No, I don't call it meaning making. I call it meaning finding, because we can't just make up our own meaning.
Right.
But if there's an objective meaning to this, some reason why this might have happened to you, because there's something unbelievable that's waiting for you to do. It's part of the overarching purpose of your life. You will grow on the other side of the trauma. You have to find its place in your story. And if you don't have God's story to base it on, Joseph knew God's story. When he's in prison for a decade, he knew that this is still part of the overarching story. He didn't lose his hope. If you don't know your place in the overarching story, if you don't think there is an overarching story, then it's what Dawkins says. The universe is just blind and pitiless. It doesn't care about you. There is no good. There is no bad. It's just a matter of opinion. Just get over it. On the other hand, if there's a God who loves you, this event, this evil, might be part of the overarching story of your life. Wow. And that's what we're called to figure out.
Well, that was only four questions, so we need to obviously have you back. Speaking of which, if you have any questions about anything that my friend Jim here said, please, please put it in the comments, or different questions, one that wasn't one of these four, because we're going to obviously have to have you back, because there are, I think that the most important thing is, listen, questions are fine. Unanswered questions are where people get in trouble. So Jay Warner Wallace, thank you so much. That was awesome.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you.